Thank you for listening to We Have Ways of Making You Talk. Sign up to our Patreon to receive bonus content, live streams, and our weekly newsletter with money off books and museum visits as well, plus early access to all live show tickets. That's patreon.com/wehaveways. Achtung, Achtung, welcome to We Have Ways of Making You Talk, USA with me, Al Murray, James Holland, and of course, John McManus. How are we all, gents?
Terrific. How you doing, Al?
Well, I'm in France at the moment, which is why my audio might sound a little bit different. I'm holed up in France. The village next to me, La Roque, was at the centre of an escape line drama, I think we've talked about before. Anyway, when they had Americans come through here, the biggest problem was that they didn't have boots that would fit them because their feet were so big.
Oh, I can definitely see that. Yeah,
yeah,
that's these big foots trotting around on French soil.
Well, I'm good. I'm a bit frazzled. I'm kind of, you know, a day out from finishing Casino.
A day out, really?
Yeah, I'm literally on the last page of the final chapter. Then I've got to go back and do a little tweaks and things, and then I've got to write the postscript, and I'm done.
Oh, that's a pretty good spot to be in.
Yeah, you know, and I've been going over and over and over the whole kind of sort of Clark Valmontoni turning up towards Monte Artemisio thing. And I've got to say, nothing has made me change my mind.
Good.
Well, good.
Good. I don't think I can stand you changing your mind.
Exactly.
No, well, I'm not going to. It's fine. You're in the clear.
We don't know if he'd survive changing his mind at this point. I mean, so it's best.
No, I don't think I would.
All the evidence keeps him where he is.
I still think it was the right call. So anyway, nearly there.
John, a couple of weeks ago, we talked about the resource at.
So it's Virginia Tech. Yeah,
that's
Virginia
right.
Tech, the American Soldier Project.
Yeah, which is the most extraordinary archive of stuff, of American soldiers being surveyed and having their sort of temperature taken by the Army during the Second World War. And you sent over some PDFs of this stuff, and The American Soldier, Combat and Its Aftermath, Volume 2, is the one I've been sort of grinding through this afternoon, by Samuel A. Stouffer, Arthur A. Lumsdaine, Marion Harper Lumsdaine, Robin M. Williams, et al. And this is a study from 1949 of what it was like, or what the soldiers thought it was like being an American soldier. And attitudes in combat, before combat, behavior in combat, chapters about that, the combat replacement, the psychoneurotic symptoms in the army, the point system for redeployment and discharge. The soldier becomes a veteran. And basically, all these aspects of what I think, in one word, we would call morale questions, and or two words, rather. And this stuff is absolutely, I mean, absolutely fascinating.
It is.
That they went to the trouble, the methodology, the questions they're immediately trying to answer. I mean, it's so interesting. The first big question they get to grips with is they look at a soldier's willingness to go to combat, a willingness to enter combat, and how prepared he feels for combat, and then what that translates into in a rifle company in terms of its non-battle casualties. So in other words, how can you detect morale via non-battle casualties, and how does that reflect on what they think their morale is? And I think that asking those kind of questions, absolutely so fascinating. I presume you've been through all of this, John, and chewed on it all and digested it. And I mean, it's amazing.
For about 30 years, I've been chewing on this. I mean,
that's amazing.
Read this book, you know, just I don't even know how many times. And of course, this is just the book they publish. What's really cool is to go and look at the original surveys in the archives, like the National Archives, what Virginia Tech and that American Soldier Project has done. And I was part of that, too, is to basically digitize it and make it available for everybody, which is really neat. It's I think just the existence of this project tells us something. It tells us that the professions were well established by the 1940s, because this is mainly sociology and social psychology and that kind of thing. In addition to like the famous Green Book series tells us that professional historians are established so that we want to document the war that way. I think that's partially what's interesting about it, too. Now, you know, if you're an American soldier, would you have been surveyed by these guys? Statistically speaking, probably not, because it's still the minority, but it's a large representative minority in a way, with multiple divisions. I mean, they really took the kind of social scientific approach of trying to get a representative sample the best they could from the various fighting fronts. And so this one, I think, is near and dear to Jim's heart. This is what stood out to me. So this is they were surveying a division from the on the Italian front. And this is, I think, the 36th Division, Texas National Guard, the T-Patchers. And so some people, in addition to just responding to the survey questions about, you know, how much did it help to hate the enemy or whatever, what they did is they had comments. And that's the minority, but they're really kind of interesting. So this guy said, if the Italian front is important enough to continue, why in the hell can't there be a few more divisions sent here instead of replacements? I've been through the whole Italian campaign as yet. I haven't been hurt. But however, day by day, I see my buddies being wounded or killed. My luck cannot hold out forever. You can never wipe out a division, but all of our old men can. How long do they expect an infantry soldier to stay and fight on the front? And then he ends it with, give someone else a chance to fight for their country and democracy, with multiple exclamation marks. And I just, when I saw that, I mean, of course, it didn't surprise me at all to hear that perspective from a guy who'd really been in it for a long time. And he's like, hey, let someone else have the honor. That was very common. But I thought of Jim's, you know, Jim's recent work, because that's exactly, you know, what you're delving into. And I mean, it's kind of the mindset, isn't it?
It absolutely is. And it's interesting because I've been following this guy who was a combat medic. And he was a doctor. He had two qualified doctors with a medical team per battalion. And so he's the kind of the number two doctor. And, you know, they take it in turn. So one would set up the kind of the aid post, aid station at the CP. But in battle, you'd follow, the other one would go literally just behind the advancing troops. So you'd patch people up, you know, give them some morphine, stem the flow, put a tag on them, and wait for the kind of, you know, the litters to come along and pick them up and take them back to the aid station. So it's all pretty kind of perfunctory, really. But he's been, you know, so that he's in the Blue Devils, so he's in the 88th Infantry Division, and they get up to the front at the beginning of March. They then hold the front, so they then get taken out of the front for like 10 days in the middle of March, while the 85th custom men turn up, and then they kind of sidle on either side of each other. This is two corps ready for Operation Diadem, the kind of sort of, you know, the big final battle of Rome. And, you know, they're in pretty full-on action from the 11th of May onwards through to the kind of 4th of June, and there's not really much let up. There's a couple of days in there, but they're kind of on it the whole time. And, you know, within a week, it's kind of, we're at 50%. You know, we've just cleared one mountain. There's another one. And then after that, there's another one. And then after that, there's another one after that. You know, we've got to march all night, and the colonel's sort of berating us for kind of being too slack. And we've got to keep going, and we've got to keep going. And that's after, you know, that's less than a month. That's like 3.5 weeks of action. And after 2 weeks of action, these guys are totally combat exhausted, totally seen enough fighting to last four lifetimes. It's just the intensity of it is just so extraordinary, I think. And then you compare them with the T-Patchers or the Thunderbirds or the Red Bulls, you know, who have been there, or the Third, of course, you know, and you get that same weariness in 19-year-old Audie Murphy.
Absolutely. And there's no rotation system. There's nothing to look forward to. So if you think about that, it's, you know, you're losing your friends every day, seeing them mainly wounded, but enough of them killed. Some have been combat fatigue, which is disturbing. And it's just sort of bleeding away every day. And you can't help but wonder to yourself, when will there be an end? And why aren't there more people here to help us? Why doesn't someone else have the honor of doing this? Because, you know, there's a whole country back there with millions of people. You know, so you just imagine the mindset every day. This guy who I, you know, quoted from, I think he was an NCO. So it's a classic example. I mean, this is a guy doing the real fighting and the real leading, you know, at the point of the spear. And to him, it all looks rather hopeless, I think. And
yeah, I think a lot of these people realize that they are going to get hit. They're going to be wounded. They will be wounded. Yep. And it's a bit like, you know, when we're talking about the Sherwood Rangers, you know, your tank will be hit, whether you're lightly wounded, heavily wounded, crippled for life, or obliterated is just the lap of the gods. But you will be hit at some point. And I think it's exactly the same for the infantry. It's really interesting. You know, I was reading a diary of a British guy, and he said, I actually felt strangely calm because I suddenly realized there is no expectation of me surviving this. So he said, therefore, I've resigned myself to it. And the moment I resign myself to it, I'm not scared anymore because there's nothing I can do about it. He said, you're scared because you think there's hope. But when there's no hope, there's no fear.
Bingo. And that's Spear's chilling comment in Band of Brothers. You remember that? It's like, you just think of yourself as dead already.
It's a hell of a thing. I mean, I was pretty struck by the sort of scale of violence when I was doing the first bit, you know, Savage Storm, looking at the 1943 campaign, but Cassino and Anzio and even Diadem, you know, the final battle for Rome. I mean, it's just awful. It's relentless.
Diadem is absolutely bloody. I mean, for the third ID, those are some of the heaviest casualties they take in the whole war. And this is when you're winning. You know, this is when you're advancing.
Yeah, they lose Abraham Johnson, doesn't he? He loses Abraham Johnson horse face. And this is like a massive moment because they've been together since North Africa and all the way through Sicily, and they're like super tight. And Horseface suddenly dies, and it's this sort of devastating moment because exactly that, all hope is gone.
Because you've come to know him just like Murphy has, and yeah, and it's very, very hard to process. And you know, Kerrigan is your one rock that you have with Murphy, you know, but you can just see just how transient it all is and how.
Yeah. And the other thing is, you know, we're now seeing, you know, the film about Mariupol and what's that new one that's just come out, Al, about the kind of in the woods where they're just using kind of sort of iPhones and personal iPhones.
I haven't seen it yet, but I mean, I know what you're talking about.
But yeah. It's exactly the same. You know, that's what's so depressing. It's that kind of, you know, the dead eyes, the kind of total exhaustion, the kind of fatalism that creeps in. You know, it's just nothing different. And I think one of the things that's so staggering about that is because we in the West, in our kind of very comfortable existence and our very comfortable lives, we cannot imagine a scenario where this violence is so extreme and so total, and your chances of getting through it are just so hopeless. And yet this was happening to our fellows, you know, this was happening to kind of people like us.
Absolutely.
And is now happening to people, you know, elsewhere in Europe and the Middle East. And I think that's what's so, I guess it's partly that's making it cut to the quick in a way that perhaps it might not do otherwise.
Partly what's depressing is that nothing changes. We don't seem to learn any lessons, and it just goes on in this endless cycle of warfare, which is sort of always the same on some levels, even as weapons change and technologies change, all that remains somewhat the same.
People still digging holes in the ground.
Well, mm-hmm. The essential thing you're asking of people doesn't change either, that they have to live in squalor and in danger of their lives and take life. I mean, that of course can't possibly change. These conclusions, the stuff in the combat and its aftermath, it's just so interesting what they're, how they're trying to correlate and sift the data to get the data, you know, to get the different data sets to speak to each other. It's absolutely, totally fascinating. And as you say, John, it shows that, you know, this stuff isn't in its infancy, or at least it's a science that people have the confidence in trying to sort of work their way through and apply and draw meaningful answers from. The other thing, though, in that very report that you quoted, you know, there's still humor in that. That NCO's humor shines through. That thing.
It does.
Do you like Stars? What do you think of Stars and Stripes magazine? Like it well enough? You know, what do you think would improve it? Well, they should try, when they write about the front, they should try coming up living here.
I love that quote. Like, yeah.
You know, even, you know, because he's giving his answers are serious in their honesty, but you also see the glimmer of a guy who's like, still got his wits about him, still got whatever chutzpah he carries with him is still fully intact. It's the same again. It's something the lot of the soldier and hasn't changed, and nor is the in lots of ways, nor is the soldier and his responses to it, that he can come at it with humor. I think is, I mean, this is always the thing I find sort of an amazing thing about the human spirit, if nothing else, is there he is. He's wisecracking when he's being asked serious questions, and in a way that makes a good point too. It's just, it's absolutely brilliant. I mean,
Makes an ultimate zinger point, doesn't it? It's I love it. I love it. It's such NCO humor. It's like, you want to know what it's like to swim in the pool? Get in the pool with me. You know, it's not that hard to figure out. I mean, that never changes. I love that kind of relentless pragmatism.
Well, there's that really good expression early in the study, a throwaway. There's only one division in the army and all the others are replacements.
The first ID. Yeah. The big red one and 10 million replacements. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, it's interesting, though, isn't it? This is taken in January 1944. 76% of those asked were not in the Sicilian campaign. You thought this was in the tea patches, did you?
Yeah, so this particular division, this guy came from the Tea Patchers, but there was a cross-section, so there could have been...
I mean, what that tells you is there's been... Because, obviously, 1st Division and 9th left, but, you know, it's quite a lot of crossover.
Oh, yeah.
45th, 3rd...
1st, 2nd Armored.
Well, there's a chart. It's a chart. Chart 4 is a comparison of veterans and non-veterans in 9th Division rifle companies grouped according to non-battle casualty rates in Normandy.
9th is a hell of a division.
Yeah, definitely.
An absolutely amazing division.
Yep.
Veterans and non-veterans. And let me surprise you or not with something. So in January of 1944, the veterans' average score and willingness for combat was 1.41. Non-veterans had a higher willingness for combat for some.
Naturally.
For some reason. And that's in January. And then they both go up, interestingly. They both those figures rise, the willingness for combat. They both go up. But I think it's fascinating that the veterans, they know better. They know better about how willing for combat you should be than the non-veterans. I think even that as a little snapshot into people is very, very interesting, that for all your experience tells you certainly don't want to be doing this again. And after all, this is the thing armies run into, isn't it? Is that they simply assume experienced people will know what they're doing and therefore be able to be looking forward to it more, but be able to deal with it better. Whereas the veterans are saying, nah, probably not really that keen, actually.
I think that's one of the great misnomers, that a veteran is going to be more effective in combat. It depends what job and what circumstances and where we are. If it's infantry in a grinding kind of long-term campaign, I don't think so at all. I mean, a veteran fighter pilot who knows what he's doing and all the, you know, ins and outs and whatever. Okay, I'll accept that. But among infantry, really not always.
I think it does help armor on the whole, because I think there's so many kind of tricks of the trade you can learn and sixth senses and, you know, there's certain things you know you can do and you shouldn't do. So I don't really think it does apply to the infantry. Of course it does, you know, but not to the same extent. The other thing I think is really interesting is you know, what branch of the army are you in now? So obviously they're mainly talking to frontline troops. So engineers, 4%. Quartermaster Corps, 2%. Medical Department, 6%. Armored Forces, only 3%. Signal Corps, 3%. Coast Artillery and Anti-Aircraft, 4%. Infantry, 30%. Field Artillery, 43% of frontline troops. And I think, you know, one of the things that's... I remember I was really struck last time I was at Carlisle, John, looking at the U.S. Army Heritage and Education Center files, where they got huge personnel files and questionnaires, and it's a great depository for diaries and letters and, you know, unpublished memoirs and all the rest of it. I would say over 50% are from the artillery. And why is this? This is because if you're in the artillery, you are much safer. Your chances of getting through unscathed are way, way, way higher than they are if you're in infantry. But you don't write a memoir if you're in the service corps because you've got nothing to say. You know, I drove some trucks. I had a couple of times where some shells came over and it was a bit hairy, but that's sort of it. You know, if you're going to write a memoir, it's because you've seen action. The problem with infantry is there aren't any left. So all the infantry memoirs, they're all late 1944, 1945. I mean, literally 70% of them. So actually finding stuff. I mean, I remember trying to find personal testimonies of frontline infantry who'd served in the tea patches at Salerno was literally didn't exist.
Yeah. Oh, I believe it.
Because they've all gone.
And contemporary diaries, good luck.
Yeah, they just don't exist.
The survivability is an issue, and also whether you can keep one.
And it's the same if you go to the Imperial War Museum in London and you look on their kind of private papers, you look up, you know, you do search for kind of Cassino or Anzio or Normandy or whatever it is, and you look up private papers, and then you kind of add in diary and all the rest of it. Literally 70% are artillery.
So artillery is close enough to be part of the action.
Part of the action. You got a story to tell. You kind of feel you've...
It may depend which part of the artillery you're in, too. If you're a forward observer, then that's a different different animal because you're with the infantry, probably.
Well, yeah, I just killed off one of my guys. He kept a beautiful diary, and he got obliterated by a shell on the 24th of May.
Being a forward observer? Yeah, right.
He's a forward observation observer. Yeah, he was in a tank. Mm-hmm. He was with the Derbyshire Yeomanry. He was a second Royal Horse Artillery. He was on 25-pounders, and he got sent forward to kind of, you know, on a radio link to kind of, you know, direct artillery.
Was it one of those tanks with a broom for a barrel? to fit the extra radio in the turret?
No, but it was quite funny because there was one point where they hit, and the commander goes, we're hit, everyone get out, jump out now. They all bail out. They realize that they've just been hit by a smoke grenade. so they then get back in again and reverse out of the situation in panic and crush a truck.
Oh, God.
And literally 3 days later, he's dead.
Mm. The thing with those figures, though, Jip, that I was quoting a moment ago, is that the veterans have a willingness for combat that's lower than you might expect, but a confidence in combat skill that's higher. So this is what they're doing with this data. Is they're slicing it in every direction to get to the heart of what the men's attitudes are. I find the modernity in this, I think, is really, really, you know, what I would maybe anachronistically consider as the modernity. It's really, really interesting. What is most interesting to observe is the fact that non-veterans are consistently better attitude scores on willingness for combat and confidence in combat stamina than veterans. The non-veterans are well up for it. The veterans have more confidence in their combat skill, but that's it.
They're not up for it, right?
They're not up for it at all.
Who could blame them?
Jim, can you detect that in the you know, because after all, as you say, the problem is these people don't exist because they've all been killed, so you don't have their memoirs.
Well, I do. I've managed to get. I mean, you know, I've managed to find the very few that there are. So there is some kind of follow through inconsistency.
You do get those people who publish in the gap between between Italy and. Normally, don't you, the odd memoir that pops actually gets published, don't you, that pops up. There's the odd one or two person. They've made it pretty, you know, Keith Douglas has made it pretty clear he doesn't like it very much, for instance.
No, none of them do. I mean, they all just think it's a filthy business. I mean, it's an awful, terrible business. I mean, I thought when I was doing Savage Storm and stuff, I thought that was quite violent, but this is on a whole another level. I mean, I've been very, I've not shied away from the kind of the gore and the guts, and I think it's you know, there's this moment where this guy's pretty hard. He's actually a teapatcher, and he's pretty hardened. He's seen a lot of action. He's seen a lot of violence. He's landed at Salerno. He's an INR man, and which is intelligence and reconnaissance. And you know, they've had the breakthrough, and he's setting up a kind of like an interrogation area for the 141st Infantry for the prisoners that are coming through. And he walks into this yard, and there is just this huge pile of dead Germans and bits of Germans. And he's absolutely revolted by this. You know, he just thinks, God, I really thought I had a hard stomach, but this is really, really terrible. And just the different pieces of human body, he can't quite sort of, his brain quite sort of compute it. And then this sort of tired kind of dog face comes and sits down and starts eating his chow, and he's next to a kind of box of body parts, and he's holding a kind of, you know, what looks like a sort of sandwich in one hand. He then rootles around in this box, pulls out a belt which has been around a kind of sort of, you know, half a corpse, takes a bottle, puts it in his pocket, and then takes a mouth of his sandwich. And my guy just says, I'm not quite sure how he did that, but it just tells you the kind of the level of brutality and awfulness and how dehumanizing this all is.
Yeah.
Definitely.
Well, yeah. That's like the story in Sean Longdon's book about some men playing a game of pontoon on a bloke's body in a lorry in Northwest Europe. That they're like, how about a game of cards, guys? And they realize they haven't got a table. So they use the cadaver that you're at that level of being inured to it eventually. If he's sitting down eating a meal next to a box body, thing of body parts, I mean, he's pretty inured, whatever his level of disgust, he can get over it, can't he? I mean, it's...
Yeah, actually, I've got it here. Let me just read it out very quickly. He says, as I watched, I saw an enlisted man hold a sandwich between his lips while he reached into the pile of flesh and bones to retrieve a belt buckle he'd seen there. Then he went on eating, having cut the buckle from a belt with a Bowie knife. It probably says something about what combat does to one's sense of propriety when I indicate that I was hungry and ate my meal washed down with Italian wine without much more thought of the lives represented by the ghoulish collection of men's anatomies.
Wow. And later during the Battle of the Bulge, they're going to sit on frozen German corpses and eat their rations that way. I mean, use them as benches, basically.
Yeah. This account, this is a guy, John Longfield. 2 days after the war was over, one of my chaps was shot accidentally, so we had to give him a decent funeral. I was on a party to take him, so we put him in a truck. He was on a wooden bench in the middle, wrapped in a blanket. We sat on the other side. It was quite a long journey. One of the guys said, "How about a game of cards, game of pontoon?" I said, "What the hell do we use as a table?" "Well, he's there. Use him as the bloody table." So we started playing cards on this bloke's body, and blood started leaking through the blanket. And I thought, "Christ, what has this war done to me?" I was quite horrified. I didn't want to be like that. But it doesn't say whether they stopped playing cards or not. So, I mean...
Carried on. Kept
but what playing. The heck? Let's have another hand.
What the hell? You know, the war's... And that's 2 days after the war ends. So, like, you know, what it does to people. I'll tell you what we'll do. We'll take a break and then I'll posit that question. Welcome back to We Have Ways USA with me, Al Murray, John McManus, James Holland. And we're finding our way through this data and what this data tells us. And what is because this book, this volume, after all, is from 1949. What's the army doing with this information at the time? What's happening to it? How is it getting processed?
Well, I think that's the other interesting point to this. I know of no commander of any, you know, senior status or whatever who is using this data, while World War II is going on. I mean, in other words, we wouldn't point to Eisenhower using this data or Eichelberger in the Pacific or something, and nothing like that. It's mainly for later, about gathering information about the war and about soldier experience that we can learn from going forward. And I think that's what's kind of interesting. At the time they're fighting this existential war and gathering these reams of data, they're not really using it in the same way that you use the after-action report that we had from our last battle to inform the next one. Sort of the history is being used, but not the social scientific surveys. So, going forward after World War II, yeah, there's a lot of attention to this. In training circles in the 50s and the 60s of how you deal with soldiers, the Army is always really attentive to this idea of taking the pulse of the soldiers. And again, I think it points to something very modern, that these guys actually matter, right? That we care what they think, because can anyone imagine a survey being done like this in the Prussian army in the 17th century or something, or in the Roman army of old yesteryears? Even those are great armies, but I don't think they care what the soldier thinks in the same way you do in a modern context.
Well, yeah, but they're also trying to get the best out of people and make people the most efficient. I mean, you know, it's interesting, isn't it? I mean, we've been talking a little bit. I think we you and I, John, we mentioned this the other day, that I think the reference point suddenly for what's going on in the world at the moment, and, you know, Ukraine and to a certain extent in the Middle East as well, actually the reference point has once again gone back to being the Second World War. Mm-hmm. Whereas, you know, our reference point in between, you know, we just thought the Second World War, that's a war that will never be repeated. That scale will never be repeated. There'll never be that level of destruction. There won't be that level of casualties, you know, so we can just sort of, to a certain extent, kind of forget about it because, you know, it's all very interesting and dramatic, but it doesn't have any kind of relevance in the modern world. Suddenly, it's become the benchmark again, you know, and that's something that would have been, you wouldn't have even considered that 15 years ago, but now you are. So I wonder whether all this, so I've got 2 points. First thing is does this American soldier in World War II suddenly have a kind of relevance that it didn't have because of what might be around the corner, you know, as people sort of gear up and Indo-Pacific and, you know, saber rattling from Russia and all the rest of it, you know, if it comes back to a conventional war again, you know, is this suddenly have a kind of relevance that it didn't have before? Second thing I think is really interesting is point 15 on the kind of, on the survey. It says, have you ever been cited in orders or received any army decorations or awards? And 82% say no. So does that, Al, do you think that fits in with the Lionel Wigram view? That it's always kind of, you know, it's no more than six men in a platoon that are doing all the work.
Jim, I have a chart in front of me. Above average in combat performance, average or indeterminate, below average, they've crunched the numbers. 33% above average or indeterminate, 39% below average in combat performance, 28%. They're running this exact
ABC.
And then there is chart 7 on page 33 chart 7 on page 34. Question: how do you think you would feel about killing a Japanese soldier? And then the chart below it is, how would you think you would feel about killing a German soldier? So it's wildly different. I mean, 38% reply, answer yes to, I would really like to kill a Japanese soldier. So you've the three groups, the below average, the average, the above average, right?
Yep.
In the below average group, 38% would really like to kill a Japanese soldier. That's your, of your ABCs, that's your Cs, Jim. The guys who aren't particularly invested in joining in.
Yeah.
44% of the average performance people, 48% of the above average guys. And what that kind of says to me is that Americans think that killing, American soldiers at this stage of the war think that killing Japanese is kind of okay.
Oh, definitely. At least half of them.
At least half of them. Entirely justifiable. I would feel that it was just part of the job without either liking or disliking it. 35% of the below average people, who don't forget are 28% of the cohort, 32% of the average people, and 34% of the above average. So of the above average people, it's 82% think that killing a Japanese soldier is part of the job or better.
Yeah, amazing.
Absolutely amazing. For the Germans, in the below average cohort, 5% would really like to kill a German soldier. 6% of the average cohort. The above average, it's 9% would really like to kill a German soldier. And then 45%, 52%, 55% feel it's just part of the job without either liking or disliking doing it. So if I've got to do it, I've got to do it. Those figures alone are absolutely staggering in the difference, aren't they?
Aren't they?
Yeah. But not surprising to me.
And that, presumably that's because kind of, you know, a sort of quarter of 25% or something, or certainly 15% of American soldiers in World War II are of German descent, right?
Well, a lot of them are, yeah.
And they're white, and they're kind of Northern Europeans and Caucasian and all that.
Whites. I mean, you know, most of the soldiers you're serving here are white.
So it's sort of racism, basically.
I think that's an element of it. And I'm basing that on just, you know, my work on the Pacific and Asia, you know, on the U.S. Army, because I have to say it was really kind of startling, even to me, the level of hatred and dehumanization and racism that you see just in ordinary letters among a lot of soldiers, and not just white soldiers, too, by the way, black soldiers, too, against the Japanese. There's anger over Pearl Harbor and Japanese behavior with the Bataan Death March and all that comes out, you know, in 44 that you would know about. But it really goes deeper than that. There's this sort of cultural and racial hatred that is absent in the European theater. There's a hatred of Nazism, I think, on the part of many American soldiers. But, you know, that's about it. Whereas there's a hatred of anything Japanese on many levels for a lot of the soldiers in the Pacific, and it's a racial kind of thing, because you just see it pop up again and again and again in the contemporary stuff from that period. Decades later, they know this isn't really acceptable. I'm going to sort of de-emphasize that part of my attitude at the time. It was startling to me, looking at a lot of those contemporary sources, just how often that cropped up in the American accounts versus the Japanese accounts, where sometimes you do see some racial hatred, but mainly against like the Filipinos or the Chinese, not as much against the Americans, except resentment of them as colonial powers kind of thing.
Imperial power. Yeah,
yeah. Yeah. You don't see those white bastards, you know, you don't see as much of that as you do like on the American side, speaking of Japanese color, you know what I mean? And so when I see, and of course I've been cognizant of that survey that we just talked about for many, many years. And what I find interesting is I think the anecdotal accounts really point toward that, that there is sometimes a bloodthirstiness among some to try and kill Japanese soldiers as much as they can. I mean, it's...
As ever with these sort of surveys, there is a striking thing that in the above average combat performance groups, 1% would feel I should not kill anyone, even a Japanese soldier. You think, who are these people?
Yeah. Why are they? Why have they been sent?
There always used to be the odd UKIP voter that wanted to vote to stay in the EU. You know, like, who are these people? who are these people? What's going on? Yeah. I think it'd be very interesting to see a British survey with those two sets of numbers, wouldn't it, James? To see what
I imagine they'd be quite similar.
Quite similar, but I don't know, and I'd just like to see it, because after all, the stomach for fighting in the Far East amongst the British soldiery, you know, who are part, after all, generally of an Indian Army effort, and attitudes to empire in the UK, you know, flip from 1939 to 1945 quite dramatically. Yeah. By the end of the war, people are not interested in fighting to defend an empire, and you know, and that's then reflected in the politics of the years that follow immediately. Of exit from India and all that sort of stuff. It'd be really, really interesting to see what, you know, if it gets even anywhere close to 48% of the above average cohort saying, I'd really like to kill a Japanese soldier. It's so fascinating, this. Well, what an amazing thing to be able to sort of nose around in, John. I mean, what a treasure trove.
It is.
Yeah, it really is. I mean, one of the things I'd say the sort of consistency, whether you're German or whether you're, you know, Allied or German in Italy, is just the kind of extreme weariness of the whole thing. You know, and you get that there's no question that the Fallschirmjäger are a little bit, you know, the German paratroopers, the Green Devils, they're a bit more kind of sparky, kind of a bit more up for it. They're a bit more kind of motivated. But even them, there is this kind of, I mean, there's a Fallschirmjäger, he comes out, you know, he's in the town and he's got, you know, he's in charge of a Zug, you know, a little platoon. They've got to get out. So they have to go down the Via Casilina to the Baron's Palace. Then they have to walk up the mountain, straight up the front of the mountain at night. Then they have to walk down the other side. They get down to the other side. Then they're told, right, you've got to go to Pontecorvo. They go to Pontecorvo. They're completely kind of separated from the rest. You know, all unit cohesion is completely gone. But they're Fallschirmjäger, so they've got to kind of fill the breach. They've got to firefight yet again. They get put in front of, you know, they get attached to some unit that they look down their noses on, and the unit commander goes, right, you need to go and attack those tanks that are coming over. And the diary memoir kind of account that I've got, he just said, I just told him this was an absolute SH1T show, and then I just punched him to the ground and told him he can get lost. I'm having some sleep first. You know, yeah, that's from a Fallschirmjäger. You kind of think, fair enough. Mm-hmm. You know,
yeah.
Who can blame it? But the consistent theme on all of this is way more is being expected of all these men than could reasonably be expected. Mm-hmm. You know, yeah. They are being pushed spectacularly hard. There is a kind of suspicion from the Americans and from Clark that the British are kind of trying to save casualties and not pushing quite as hard as the Americans are pushing. There's probably some truth to that, but I mean, you know, we're talking about degrees of hardness. I mean, it's still harder and tougher and more brutal than you know in our worst nightmares. I mean, it's just the relentlessness of it. Here's an example. Yeah, go on.
Speaking of that, we've talked about Merrill's Marauders, of course. And So here's a response from one of the Merrill's Marauders guys that exactly highlights what Jim just mentioned. We were kept fighting a long 5 months. And he's talking about the spring 1944 campaign in North Burma. We needed a rest, but never got any, which brought down plenty of sicknesses, and too many died because he was running the ground. We will not last a month doing the same thing again. Our medical officers say we should not be sent back in combat because of our physical conditions, but General Stilwell doesn't know what a human is. He thinks we should run on K rations like an automobile runs on gas. Something should be done about this. And I mean, that is it to a T. And that's exactly what you would experience as one of the Merrill's Marauders. You remember 5307 composite unit, you know, that silly thing. And you're basically kept there in this North Burma jungle, pushing for Miet Kina, Michinar, whatever you want to call it, for months. As long as you can stand, you're going to be there. And I love how he mentioned Stilwell, because the perception among a lot of the Merrill's Marauders is that he was at fault. He was driving him like a slave driver and all this. And he kind of was, but it's a classic failure of leadership on this level, in my opinion. Had Stilwell shown himself among them, and he was at the front a lot, but he didn't really circulate with the soldiers themselves that much. Had he done that and circulated and said, look, guys, I know this is horrible, but I can't get replacements for you. I just don't have it. And we have to do this or everything we've done the last 3 months is going to be meaningless. I almost guarantee you almost everybody would have said, oh, I get it now. Sign me up. I would do it. Instead, there's that kind of misfire in communication. So the Merrill's Marauders, many of them for the rest of their lives, blamed him in the abstract for what something that really wasn't quite his fault. And I think it was because of that miscommunication. So the reason that's important is not just to understand what happens in the North Burma campaign, but I think that's happening at a global level, unit after unit after unit, where the three of us are in the middle of this mess at Casino or in Normandy or at the Bulge or, you know, wherever in Saipan, whatever. And we don't see any purpose to this. And we don't see any end to it. And it's just hopeless, and that intrudes on our combat effectiveness, I think, and our willingness to do this.
Chart 4, Testimony of Infantry Company Officers as to Factors in Battle Performance, Pacific and Europe, Spring 44. Percentage who observed this is what it is, and who also said it had a very bad or rather bad effect on battle performance. Fatigue of troops being kept in combat too long, 72% in the Pacific observe that as a thing that's affecting their combat performance. In Europe, 71%. So clearly that's the thing. The number one gripe is we've been doing this too long. Lack of food, clothing, personal equipment, 43%, 36%. And then the other one, you know, inadequate communication with other companies and with higher headquarters. In the Pacific, 34% think that that's bad for their combat performance. Inability of company officers to make mission clear to men, 21%. All this combination of factors, but being in the line too long, or the perception thereof, is the one that they're all complaining. I mean, 72%. That, you know, that's a landslide, isn't it?
It is.
They definitely think that's the problem. Whereas training, personal needs, you know, blah blah blah, inadequate reconnaissance of any enemy positions, 52%. I mean, it's. They're weighing all these things together, but it's that one that's the one that leaps out.
And it doesn't surprise me at all. And it's, you know, as much as we all love Band of Brothers, it's a bit misleading because that unit's combat was episodic. It's an airborne unit that kind of tours in and out and doesn't suffer the same kind of, you know, attritional kind of on the line all the time casualties that normal infantry units do. That's really more typical for World War II combat, but you could never do a miniseries that way because all the people you'd be hooked onto would be dead or gone within a week. And that's unfortunately the way it was. If we're in a rifle company in the Big Red 1 or the 3rd ID or the 77th Division in the Pacific or the 1st Marine Division, I mean, we've got 250 to 300% turnover in the course of a few battles. And that's what's happening here. And so, I mean, I think it's amazing they found people to survey in the first place. Yeah. And I know for a fact they had to go to the hospitals to get some. I mean,
you know, and what motivates a man from Sulphur Springs, Texas to kind of cross the ocean and hack his way up a rain-sodden mountain in the middle of Italy is absolutely beyond me. I mean, it's
me too. That's what's been. I've been chasing that question forever. That or if we'll put it on the other side of the world, to hack his way up the side of Mount Tapacho on Saipan or somewhere in New Guinea or wherever it happens to be. I don't care how much you hate the Japanese. I mean, that's going to go out the window when you're that miserable.
Sometimes a guy would say, how do I keep going? You have to fight with yourself. You don't want to be a quitter. You know you're all right. That's a guy, wounded veteran, being interviewed in hospital.
Very profound what he's saying, because I think that's exactly it for a lot of them. And so what I've tended to believe is the motivator is the guys around them that it's certainly we think of the positive elements of this, the camaraderie. The bonds, the strong friendship. And I do think there's that, but I also think there's a sort of negative element of it that ends up leading to combat performance, which is I'm just as good a man as you. I don't like you. I have total contempt for you, but I'm not going to give you the satisfaction of seeing me quit. I'm going to hang in there to show you what's what. And I think that's a big part of it too, because let's face it. I mean, there's a lot of people who are thrown together who don't have that much in common. Come from different places, different educational levels, different backgrounds. They may not like each other a whole lot. They have political disagreements, maybe. Shocker. Imagine that from among Americans, right?
Well, listen to this. So this is a diary of a padre of the Seaforth Highlanders of Canada. So he's a Canadian padre, and he says, this is before the assault of the Sanger Line on 22nd of May, 1944. The artillery barrage is simply terrific. Kitty Hawk's bomb and machine gun. Jerry shells drop close. My boys move in tonight. I see them off. How can one ever forget the scene? New boys with fear and nerves and anxiety hidden under quick smiles and quick seriousness. Old campaigners with faraway look. It is the hardest thing to watch without breaking into tears. You know, because he's going to have to go and fetch all these guys and bury them the following day, which of course he then does. It's just heartbreaking. It's clearly there's only so many times you can do this. You know, I'm very taken with the bank of courage, this idea that you have a kind of tank of courage, you know, and it's when you go into the combat, it's kind of, you know, it's there, it's full, and it just dips and dips and dips. And if you don't replenish it enough, you know, if the tanker doesn't come around and refill it, then you know, you'll run out and then you'll break and that'll be that. And it's clearly the case. And a bit like kind of, you know, different types of battery, you know, some run out really quickly, some are Duracell and keep going a bit longer. And, you know, there's no rhyme nor reason to who will last out and who won't. But the other thing I would say that the kind of sort of takeaway I've had from all of this, and you'll remember this, Al, from when we were looking at Jörg Zellner's diary, the German with the kind of the battalion that kept being shredded. You know, there's this sadness to the whole thing. There's this kind of sort of, this kind of wistfulness that it's my lot that I found myself being this age in this particular time and caught up in this particular horror story. And it kind of bubbles between extreme anger, fatalism, wistfulness, just utter sadness and fear that you're not going to be able to kind of hold it all together. And it's there's a sort of mean line, which is kind of sort of human spirit, endurance, keeping going. And what you see is it sort of flickers and flickers and flickers. And then at some point it drops, and it drops because you lose your nerve, because you get wounded, because you die, because something happens, but you cannot keep that line going. You it's just impossible.
That's spot on, Jim, because I think that, and I think it's especially moving, at least for me, because we weren't born in that time and place. And yet we think about that time and place a lot, don't we? And we think about then in learning about it, how lucky we are now and how unfathomable this is. But here is something very human in that connection with people 80 years ago, that they're really not all that different than we are now. They just happen to be in that circumstance and they just kind of deal with it the best they can.
That's the thing that I've been really, really struck by in the last sort of 3 years of research on this subject matter, is that, you know, L.P. Hartley famously wrote that the past is a foreign country. And you kind of know what he means. And when you're thinking about kind of Edwardian times, which he's writing about in The Go-Between, you kind of think, well, yeah, okay, maybe. And when you're thinking about Tudor times, you're thinking, okay, yeah, maybe. And when you're thinking about Romans, I mean, the point that my brother Tom always makes is that, you know, Romans have fear and love and hate and happiness and laughter and all the rest of it, but they are not like us. They are just not. They're totally different people.
Another planet.
Yeah. It's another planet. You know, the past really is a foreign country. The thing about these combatants, that these diaries that you're reading, these letters, these memoirs, which are based on diaries, is that they are absolutely people that you and I know and can relate to. This guy that just gets blown up being a forward observation officer, he's absolutely brilliant. I just know his type. He's obviously clever. He's witty. He is absolutely at heart completely bone idle, but he also knows that when he needs to kind of when he needs to crank it up, he'll crank it up. And all the men love him.
Hard relate.
Well, sort of, yeah. And he'll do anything to avoid having to do something. But at the same time, if he's got to do it, he'll do it, and he does it really, really well. You know, he is much loved by his men. But there's nothing he likes more than breakfast in bed and taking it easy and kind of, you know, just avoiding any duty that he possibly can. And he's so identifiable, you know, and he's sort of building up for his birthday in April, and he's sort of like, you know, getting the booze in for tonight, having a bit of a party and a mess. You know, the following day got a terrible hangover. You know, it's just so identifiable as a young 24-year-old. I mean, there is no different difference between him and his attitudes, his likes, his loves, his fears, his irritations, than someone of that age today. And that's what makes his death so completely devastating, because you feel you know him. I mean, it's just horrendous.
Yeah, and it's all a question of endurance, isn't it?
Of every kind, yeah.
Of every kind.
Well, that's been fascinating, hasn't it? I mean, yeah. that book is amazing.
It's incredible.
I'm going to have to go and try and get a real copy.
We're going to need to talk about this again, I'm afraid, John.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
I'm only on page 34 out of 698.
The footnote about how the Japanese nation should be exterminated.
You think, yes. That's interesting, okay. Isn't it?
That's to talk about another time. Incredible.
Yeah. Oh, there's and all kinds of stuff. Yep.
Well, thanks, everyone, for listening. We hope you found this as interesting as obviously we have. I mean, just to get drawn into this way of looking at things is absolutely fascinating. So that's the American Soldier Collection, which is well worth a look if you get the chance. Thanks for listening, everybody. We'll be back very, very soon. Great to talk to you, John and Jim. Au revoir.
Yeah, absolutely.
Au revoir. À bientôt.